UAB Medcast is an ongoing medical education podcast. The UAB Division of Continuing Education designates that each episode of this enduring material is worth a maximum of 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credit. To collect credit, please visit uabmedicine.org/medcast and complete the episode's post-test.
Welcome to UAB Medcast, a continuing education podcast for medical professionals. Bringing knowledge to your world, here's Melanie Cole.
The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recommends that young women aged 13 to 15 undergo a dedicated reproductive health visit. The purpose of this visit is for education, prevention, and anticipatory guidance and should be tailored to the individual patient. Here to tell us about the clinical aspects of pediatric and adolescent gynecology is Dr. Janine Arbuckle. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at UAB Medicine. Welcome to the show, Dr. Arbuckle. Explain a little bit about pediatric and adolescent gynecology and what types of services do you offer?
Yes, thanks so much for having me, Melanie. Pediatric and adolescent gynecologists are specialized OBGYNs who focus in the care of children and adolescents. We're able to see patients between newborn up to age 21 and really for any reproductive need or any concerns about their normal development. The development of their genital tract and or breasts.
So when is an exam indicated in a young child or adolescent? And what do you do at that first exam to make a young woman comfortable with the difficulties of that first exam?
Absolutely. So it depends on what the patient is presenting for. So if a patient comes in with a specific problems that warrant an exam, so for instance, if they have any concerns about an abnormal discharge or the normalcy of their anatomy, then an exam is indicated. We don't do routine pelvic exams in adolescents until they do turn age 21. So the majority of our patients will not require a pelvic exam unless they're having problems. Definitely navigating that first pelvic exam can be difficult. It's often helpful to have a parent available or find some way to distract the child or adolescent. So oftentimes in our children's clinic space, we have TVs on, children will use their phone, and they just are kind of distracted from the fact that a genital exam is going on. In addition, we try to normalize that we all have genitals and we all have body parts of our that have to be specific body parts that have to be evaluated by doctors to make sure that they're healthy. And so we try to make it a comfortable space, allow them to kind of free play and be distracted and doing things that are entertaining for them so that it's not so intrusive to their kind of perception and physical space. Those girls who need a more detailed exam, definitely we see in our adult office, and we have an environment that, again, is really friendly and staff that has specialized training in discussing what the components of a pelvic exam with those girls that need a more detailed exam.
You mentioned discharge or anatomical concerns. What are some common concerns of adolescents and their parents in terms of visiting their OBGYN and some common pediatric gynecological disorders?
That's a great question. So if you kind of divide the population into two halves, the younger patients who will complain of a vaginal discharge or a genital complaint is most specifically and most commonly a nonspecific vulvitis. So the child will complain of an itch or a burn and just not have they'll have a generalized discomfort in their vulvar area. That's most commonly due to just overgrowth of normal bacteria that lives in the area, either bowel flora or even respiratory flora. And the most important thing to inform the patient and their parent of is that that's something that can actually be treated with minimal intervention. So the most common thing for young girls is, again, a nonspecific vulvitis that we actually recommend just treating with improved hygiene measures and a couple other things that can make the area more comfortable. It's rare for there to be anything more than that, just nonspecific overgrowth. And older girls, the girls who are post-puberty, they'll often complain of a vaginal discharge that's actually perfectly normal and what we call physiologic. So normalizing that there should always be some degree of a vaginal discharge and highlighting those components of an abnormal discharge from just an education standpoint is all that's often necessary.
So if it's a non-infectious valvovaginitis, they don't like the smell or the look of it, and even maybe a mother is concerned, what would you tell other pediatricians and or physicians about explaining to the girls the normalcy of some of this.
Yeah. So unfortunately, in American culture, there is a perception that female genitals should all be on the inside and that there should never be anything on the outside. So one of the common things that we'll get referrals for or even questions from parents or children, specifically the postpubertal girls, is do my genitals look normal and they need to be reduced? So a common concern is that, for instance, the labia minora are too large. So number one, we start with education, and I talk about what the genitals look like in a prepubertal child, and then most commonly the labia minora are flush with the outside. They aren't really an external organ. And then when we go through puberty, the natural progression is for all of those tissues to grow and have a little bit more of an external appearance. A labia minora can be anywhere between the size of 4 centimeters to 7 centimeters and still be completely normal. And so try to normalize that through education. And then honestly, I use as a resource, there's a plaster mound, which is going to sound crazy, of various vulvas. And it's called the Great Wall of Vaginas. And it makes a lot of our adolescents kind of teeter and they think it's funny or they're grossly embarrassed. But it's actually a way to show girls what normal anatomy looks like. So they have this idea of this perfect vulva that is honestly kind of infantile, which is actually not what a postpubertal vulva should look like. So educate about the normal pubertal progression, and then I also refer them to that site so they can see some of other normal variants of what the external genitalia for a female will look like.
Dr. Arbuckle, unfortunately, children are vulnerable to the same sexually transmitted infections that adults carry. So if a child comes to you and presents with irritation or some infection, is there some standard of care that you would run to see if it was a sexually transmitted infection or if abuse has taken place?
That's a great question. So we do at UAB have a specialized clinic for the evaluation for concerns for sexual abuse. If there is a concern by the family for sexual abuse, it's most appropriate to go through that clinic. It's called the CHIPS Clinic, and it's run through Children's. Most people will be referred there through DHR. If girls come in and they have no concern for a sexually transmitted infection, that's certainly something that we're still aware of as a possibility. Things that would heighten the concern for exposure to sexually transmitted infection is if there's a discharge that's purulent, meaning more thick, yellow, thick secretions, or green. Those are things that make us much more concerned for there being an infection that is sexually transmitted rather than just an overgrowth of other bacteria. The screening for that can happen in two ways. The actual secretions can be tested, or we can test in urine. Obviously, that's nothing that anybody ever wants to go through, but if there is a purulent discharge and there is a sexually transmitted infection, it's important that those get treated and then that a case be opened with DHR so that child can be protected.
And along those lines, the HPV vaccine being given to young girls as young as 9 now and up through the age of 26, do you, as a pediatric and adolescent gynecologist, involve in that? Is that just the pediatrician? And how do you discuss that with young girls and what it means?
Absolutely. HPV vaccination is one of the things that I'm actually most passionate about. As a consultant, it's often hard to administer the HPV vaccine. So, for instance, we'll often see one patient just once. We may see them once a year. And the HPV vaccination, depending on the patient's age, does require 2 or more visits. And sometimes it's not convenient for our consulting patients to come to our office for those vaccinations. I do make it a routine part of my practice to educate families about the HPV vaccine, and we do offer it in our clinic. If it's convenient for them to start the vaccination series with us, we will, and then they're educated on how to complete that vaccination series with their pediatrician. As far as the conversation about the vaccine, I try to highlight that it is a vaccine that has been proven to protect against cancer, and that's a rare opportunity. I talk about the prevalence of HPV and that the vast majority of adults do consensual sexual contact will come in contact with HPV. We talk about the sequelae of HPV, head and neck cancers, genital cancers, and that those cancers are indiscriminate. So regardless of your own behavior, you may be exposed to those viruses through sexual contact. And then we talk about the vaccine, that it's very well tolerated. Unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation in the culture, especially with social media, regarding the safety of HPV vaccine. And then those patients who are, and specifically those parents who are concerned about the safety of HPV vaccination, I refer them to the CDC's website, as well as the Institute of Medicine's most recent study, where they looked at the safety of all vaccines. And they actually showed that HPV vaccine is no more dangerous than the chickenpox vaccine. And while parents wouldn't hesitate at all to immunize their children against chickenpox, they likewise should not hesitate to vaccine against HPV.
The landscape has changed for both pediatricians and for pediatric and adolescent gynecologists in the impact of social media and the sexual and social wellness of adolescents. Is this something that you think pediatricians and physicians should possibly delve into, because it really has changed how we speak to our young children and what they're learning in the outside world?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. So we try to talk about, oftentimes when I walk into a patient's room, daughter has her phone, mom has her phone, they're both navigating their own social networks and their own resources, which may or may not be accurate. And so we try to talk about specifically relationships and how to have safe and healthy relationships. Unfortunately, I think a lot of girls kind of underestimate the internet world and how widespread it is and how depersonalized it is. And so I try to help them build self-esteem as well as take steps to keep themselves safe on the internet. I think there's a lot of photo sharing apps, live chatting that can actually put girls at a place, in a vulnerable place, where they could be potentially victimized. And so I try to educate them about safe spaces to be to share their bodies. For instance, it's inappropriate to be sharing physical pictures of any private parts via text or over the internet. And really just try to help them realize that their bodies are precious, and that they, though it may be convenient and easy to share images of it, that those images are really inappropriate to be shared in that medium.
So in summary, Dr. Arbuckle, tell other physicians what you'd like them to know about pediatric and adolescent gynecology and when to refer to a specialist.
Yeah. So pediatric and adolescent gynecologists offer that care, again, from newborn to age 21. And there are some general OBGYNs who are comfortable seeing across that spectrum, and there are some pediatricians who are comfortable seeing across that spectrum. In addition, adolescent medicine providers also have a lot of overlap in the patients that we see. Often our referrals will come from physicians who are not comfortable seeing that age group. And so if there's a physician who thinks, hey, I think this patient might be the better suited by an IUD, but I'm not comfortable placing it in an adolescent, that's a great referral. Or if there's recurrent problems, recurrent ovarian cysts, disorders like polycystic ovarian syndrome, Mullerian anomalies, abnormal uterine bleeding, or amenorrhea, those are probably our most common consultations. And we're always available for even just curbside. So if somebody is managing somebody and they've gotten to the point where they're not really comfortable, just a phone call to say, hey, what would be your next step? And if that next step doesn't work, always being available as a backup and to go a little bit further in the exploration of the patient's pathology.
Tell us about your team. Why is UAB so great to work with?
Yeah, so I am fortunate to have two partners. Kim Hoover is the director of the Pediatric and Adolescent Gynecology Subdivision, and we've just hired a new partner, Dr. Aaron Cook, and you really, truly could not find a more dedicated and passionate co-workers to work with. Each of them has their own niche and their own favorite patient populations. They're great communicators with both patients and their mothers. And then we have a dedicated team of nursing staff and CMAs who are really passionate about advocating for these young women and providing them safe and comfortable care.
Thank you so much for being with us today. And a community physician can refer a patient to UAB Medicine by calling the MIST line at 1-800-UAB-MIST. That's 1-800-822-6478. You're listening to UAB Medcast. For more information on resources available at UAB Medicine, you can go to uabmedicine.org/physician. That's uabmedicine.org/physician. This is Melanie Cole. Thanks so much for listening.